Hello, and welcome to episode 130 of the Sea Control Podcast, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security. My name is Matthew Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control, and on this episode, we bring you Professor Steve Biddle of George Washington University to talk about, in his words, the artist formerly known as Air Sea Battle. He demystifies the mechanics behind its competition with anti-access area denial technologies and provides a number of policy recommendations for the United States. This interview was conducted by SimSec's Director of External Relations, Mina Pullman, marking her triumphant return to podcast hosting after episode 128 with Bonnie Glazer. We'll get started with this eye-opening interview after a brief word about our organization.
SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Join us today.
Dear SimSec listeners, my name is Mina Pullman, and as Director of External Relations for the Center for International Maritime Security, it is my honor today to be interviewing Professor Steve Biddle at George Washington University with the Elliott School of International Affairs. Professor Biddle, thank you so much for joining us today. Our first question is about anti-access area denial, which has become a popular concept when discussing China's maritime strategy in the Western Pacific. What is the political and strategic motivation for China to pursue A2AD, as it is commonly known, and what are the greatest technical limitations of A2AD? How limiting will a fully mature Chinese A2AD capability be for U.S. operations in the Western Pacific?
Well, denial strategies of this kind are actually very common historically for either weak maritime powers or for rising maritime powers that are still at a disadvantage relative to a stronger foe. So, for example, the Soviet Union during the Cold War began with an effort to protect its coast and its inland waters from the U.S. Navy, and only as it got stronger over time did it make any effort to project power at all further from its shores than that. So it's a natural beginning point for any emerging maritime power. What makes A2AD, as people call it, anti-access area denial, unique, is that the particular technologies that have been emerging for the last, really, two decades or more have the potential to take this philosophy of defend your coast and your inland waters from a superior power projection capability and to push it out way beyond what would normally be considered the extent of a coastal defense inland waters strategy. And in fact, if you look at the reach that modern reconnaissance, surveillance, and target acquisition technologies can obtain, and the range that missiles targeted by these technologies could obtain, then in fact, you could not with difficulty imagine a Chinese A2AD zone extending all the way out to or beyond the second island chain. You know, a long, long way from the Chinese coast, and far enough, in fact, to threaten all the United States' major allies in the Pacific Rim, which, if that capability were ever realized fully by the Chinese, would be a major change in the geopolitical situation in the Western Pacific. Now, you mentioned the issue of potential vulnerabilities in A2AD. And as I mentioned, reconnaissance, surveillance, and target acquisition technology is at the heart of the whole concept. If you can't find it, you can't destroy it. And the RISTA, reconnaissance, surveillance, and target acquisition potential, at the heart of this is also one of its greatest vulnerabilities. And the central problem here is that to get the kind of all-weather, day-night, 24/7 surveillance coverage that would be needed to make the most of what modern precision-guided missiles at these kinds of ranges could do, largely requires radar. And radar, of course, is an active emitter. And as an active emitter, it gives away its location and becomes vulnerable to counterattack. Many of the same technologies that create A2AD can also threaten A2AD as long-range precision-guided, terminally-guided weapons proliferate. It's particularly easy to target transmitting, emitting radars. And if you destroy the radar, you then make it much, much harder for the Chinese to extend the reach of these kinds of technologies to anything like the distances that people talk about when they talk about the second island chain.
Is the joint concept for access and maneuver in the global commons, previously and more commonly known as air-sea battle, a meaningful way to deal with the challenge of A2AD? And how cost-effective is this concept relative to anti-access area denial?
Yeah, the artist formerly known as air-sea battle, the new concept that whose name no one uses because it's so awkward, is a natural response very much in the tradition of the way the U.S. military responds to these kinds of capabilities if you're worried about Chinese A2AD getting out anywhere near the second island chain.
Preemptively destroy it.
Rather than tolerating this, the basic idea behind the concept is we are going to reach into the Chinese mainland and destroy before they can be used the radars, the logistical infrastructure, and the mobile missile launchers that are required for A2AD to actually reach out very far at all beyond the Chinese coast. Now, it involves a lot more than just that idea. The name, you know, now bygone name of air-sea battle, was meant to harken back to the Cold War concept of air-land battle, which was all about the Army and the Air Force combining their activities in two different domains, the land and the sky, to be more effective against Soviet forces in a potential invasion of Western Europe. The idea of air-sea battle is similarly, it would combine multiple domains. It would have the Air Force and the Navy, for example, cooperating so as to make it easier to deal with what would otherwise be an extraordinarily difficult problem in penetrating, you know, hundreds of miles inland onto the Chinese mainland to destroy mobile targets that can hide amidst the complex background of the Earth's surface. Notwithstanding all the advantages of multi-domain operations in this respect, it's still an immensely difficult project. And it has often seemed to me that the right way to think about this project, air-sea battle versus Chinese A2AD, is that you have to look out beyond the immediate military balance into the fairly distant future, because the technologies we're talking about won't mature to the point where they're a serious threat to the second island chain until you get out into the more distant future. But when you decide that to evaluate this fairly, I have to look out beyond, you know, 2017, beyond 2020, the paper that I wrote recently on this looks all the way out to 2040, then you have to assume that both the United States and China are going to be engaged in a rather energetic, two-sided, adaptive competition in which they each try and thwart the other's capabilities, and in which both of them are plausible economic peers after a decade or two of this competition. So if you think of the competition between air-sea battle and A2AD in the context of a long-term, mutually adaptive competition between economic peers, then, as your question suggests, the cost-exchange ratio becomes decisive. If the way the United States is going to deal with the A2AD threat to the second island chain is by spending China into the ground, which we did successfully against the Soviet Union in the Cold War, we're going to spend ourselves into the ground. Because whereas the Soviet Union was a declining economic power that you could beat in an all-out, economically exhausting arms race, we're not going to be able to do that with China unless the economic projections are way wrong. So what that means in turn is if one side or the other has the cost advantage, it means that they're going to win the race if it's fought to extremis. And when you look at the details of how air-sea battle would operate against A2AD, there's a systematic cost advantage in creating and maintaining area denial as opposed to battering it down in a preemptive strike as air-sea battle would do.
That makes a lot of sense. Except I like the comparison, the historical comparison to the Soviet Union and the situation we're facing with China now. In your paper that you mentioned, you give several concrete suggestions for the U.S. going forward, such as investing in larger, heavier missiles and anti-ship missiles with a range of at least 600 kilometers, deploying long-range mobile surface-to-surface missiles to the region, and making policy decisions to reduce U.S. reliance on space and restrict Chinese access to space. What are the challenges toward implementing these recommendations politically and operationally speaking?
Yeah, let me before I answer the question about the challenges, let me just explain very briefly why those things are important. Because they emerge naturally from the problem of RISTA and countering RISTA in a long-term competition. Radar, as I pointed out earlier, is a central technology in all this. That means defending radar and limiting the range of the opponent's radar is critical in all of this. And much of what our paper does is to talk about a long-term competition between an attempt to push radar coverage further out and an attempt by its opponents to keep it from getting further out.
Mm-hmm.
And the modernization and acquisition agenda that you just talked about is driven largely by the requirements of that competition. So, for example, space. The easiest way to extend radar coverage over an arbitrarily great distance is to put a radar in space. And the Soviets did very much the same thing during the Cold War. This isn't a particularly exotic technology. If, in fact, the United States grants military sanctuary to space, what we are doing is enabling China, through space-based radar, to establish RISTA coverage that could threaten any U.S. ally in the Western Pacific. The range of the missiles and the ability of terminal guidance to take advantage of that range, given surveillance that can localize targets, is very impressive. So it seems to me that unless the United States is prepared to blind Chinese space-based radar, then A2AD could undermine the entire U.S. alliance system in the Pacific. And therefore, it's important, I think, that the United States seriously consider both the technologies and the programmatics necessary to develop anti-satellite weapons that could remove this threat, but also that it think very hard about the policy issues associated with whether we do or do not want to wage war in space, whether we do or we do not want to pursue weapons bans in orbit, because the conventional wisdom in the United States for a long time has been that space is a unilateral U.S. advantage, and therefore if we could somehow make space a demilitarized zone, this would benefit the United States. In the emerging world of potentially very long-reach Chinese A2AD, that older assumption that space is a unilateral U.S. advantage is subject to serious challenge. If China has military access to space, the military prognosis in the Western Pacific could be radically different. Now, if you then say, let's at least take seriously the idea that the United States might want to deny military sanctuary in space to the Chinese, what would be involved in that? And obviously part of what's involved in that is the Chinese won't grant us sanctuary either. Anti-satellite weapons have massive cost advantages over satellites. If sanctuary is denied in space, either side is going to be able to destroy satellites vastly more cheaply than either side can replace them. But that means that the United States then has to be prepared to make war without access to space. There's no reason in principle why we can't do this. All the things that we now do with space could be done with airborne alternatives, communications relays, airborne radars for surveillance. We could, if we chose to do it, develop the capacity for redundancy where we can make war without these capabilities. We have not expected to do that for a very long time. So it seems to me that one important acquisition priority and planning priority is to recover the ability to wage war in the Pacific without space-based assets. Now, for reasons that your question hints at, this is not a popular agenda. The general thrust of U.S. force design and modernization for at least a generation, maybe two, has been to rely more heavily on space-based assets to enable a smaller, more widely distributed maritime and terrestrial force structure to survive. It seems to me that it's time to seriously rethink that. But of course, that's subversive of a very long tradition now of thinking about force design in the United States. Now, also important as acquisition and modernization issues, if you think about the military problem in the Western Pacific this way, is you need to develop capabilities with the range needed to keep Chinese radars from venturing too far beyond China's shores and extending A2AD beyond what we argue in our paper is a natural limit in the neighborhood of 400 to 600 kilometers from the coastline. If we deploy things like long-range radiation homing missiles that can take advantage of the range that you would need to force Chinese radars back over the mainland. Similarly, A2AD in a long-run, two-sided, mutually adaptive competition is something both sides will be able to employ and should want to employ. So just as, in our view, the impracticality, that the cost disadvantage of preempting Chinese A2AD should prevent us from doing it, so China would have a cost disadvantage in trying to preempt an American A2AD capability. And the capacity to close much of the Western Pacific to Chinese maritime traffic is an important military capability the United States would want to have. To do that, we need, for example, anti-ship missiles of a range that's capable of exploiting a 400 to 600 kilometer U.S. A2AD bubble beyond friendly held land masses, and that will require anti-ship missiles of substantially greater range than, for example, today's Harpoon.
As I picked up your article and was going through it, as someone who's interested in maritime security, what really struck me was the space part of it, because that's something I hadn't really considered or thought about. But that is, as you point out, a debate that we probably should be having more actively, more publicly. And it's going to have implications, even for people who are might think that they're, oh, just focus on the maritime security, but it's going to have implications across all of U.S. security policy.
So absolutely.
I found that point to be particularly interesting. In continental warfare, many great powers, this is coming from your quote, in continental warfare, many great powers fail to master complicated modern system force employment, and variations in such behavior have been more important than technology per se for observed outcomes. If you could begin elaborating on the central finding of your book, Military Power, and begin sort of, I guess, giving a sense of what you mean by force employment and the concept behind that, and then weighing the relative importance of technological change versus force employment.
Yeah, I think arguably the most important trends in land warfare, or continental warfare, the land surface and the air above it, since about 1900, has been the discovery by most great power militaries very early in the 20th century, before the end of the First World War, actually, that the complexity of the Earth's surface offers enough cover and concealment to substantially shield land forces from the increasing potential lethality of modern weaponry. To do that, however, to operate a mass military of potentially millions of soldiers in a way that can exploit the natural complexity of the Earth's surface for cover and concealment means accepting tremendous complexity in tactics and operational art. Relative to, for example, Napoleonic tactics, in which armies could be lined up in shoulder-to-shoulder linear formations and simply marched towards an objective, if you're in fact going to use the complexity of the Earth's surface to provide cover in ways those massed shoulder-to-shoulder formations couldn't do, then you're going to have to break down those massed formations into small handfuls of soldiers, few enough in number that they can fit into the little folds in the Earth and small crevices and small shadows that create what militaries ironically call dead ground. Dead ground, of course, is where you can live. I didn't coin the term. And get out from under modern firepower. But that means you've got thousands upon thousands of small formations of independently maneuvering soldiers working their way through the terrain, trying to find their way forward by the path that provides the most cover and the least exposure. To do that and not get caught by surprise in the open requires that thousands of junior officers in a mass military have the military professional training to use their own eyes, their own judgment, their own ability to size up the terrain and the likely fields of fire of enemy weapons to be able to wind through complicated terrain and find the right way forward. Moreover, even if they do that, they're occasionally going to get caught in the open. If you're going to advance any significant distance towards any meaningful objective, sooner or later you're going to get caught in the open. to cross those open patches of ground requires suppressive fire. The weapon types that are best suited for suppressive fire are machine guns and artillery that have access to enough ammunition to keep the enemy's heads down while you sprint from one patch of cover to another. Access to that kind of ammunition requires location in the rear, where you can safely amass that quantity of ammunition. That in turn means not only do we have thousands of small formations led by junior officers winding their way over complex terrain towards an objective, they're depending on coordinated activity from fire support systems that they can't see and that are firing over their head or across their frontage at targets in front of them that the gunners can't see. And if they get this just a little bit wrong, the result is catastrophe. If the gunners fire a bit short, they slaughter their own forces. If the gunners fire a bit long, they fail to suppress the enemy, and you get slaughtered when you get caught in the open. So the sheer complexity of all of these moving parts and all of this communication demand and all of this coordination requirement is a daunting undertaking for mass militaries consisting often of people who've just recently been drafted into military service and have not had a 40-year military career to learn how to do all of this stuff. The net result of all that is, in principle, the complexity of the Earth's surface can, in fact, substantially mitigate the nominal technical lethality of improving weapons, but only if a military is capable of carrying out very complicated techniques on the battlefield. And some militaries have, and other militaries have not. And in fact, the book argues that much of the observed variance in military outcomes in continental warfare since 1900 is attributable to variations in how well or badly any given mass military mastered this very complex set of tasks, much more so than was their weaponry a bit more lethal than the other side's weaponry was 10 years ago. But all of that note is driven at its base by the complexity of their surface as a military environment. Now let's transfer this picture to maritime warfare and air warfare per se, and now the background environment is much simpler. Now, obviously, maritime environments aren't as simple as the brown wooden tabletop on which the recording devices for this interview now sit. Right? There are thermoclines in the ocean, sea states can create background clutter, there are clouds in the sky, so it's not literally, you know, transparent. On the other hand, it's a lot more transparent than the Fulda Gap in West Germany, or than the Ardennes Forest from the 1940 campaign, or practically any terrestrial land environment. And what that means, then, is that whereas maritime warfare can be extremely complex, and A2AD, in the way we're talking about it now, requires very rapid coordination among a significant range of very different pieces of equipment located in very different places, so it's not a trivial enterprise by any means, but by comparison with the kind of complexity we're talking about on land, this is a lower order of difficulty. And what that suggests is that probably in the maritime and air domain, the relative contribution of technological variations to combat outcomes is likely to be greater relative to skill and the mastery of complexity by comparison with the picture on land. None of that is to suggest that either technology is irrelevant on land, that's not true, or that skill is irrelevant at sea and in the air, certainly that's not true. But given that they both matter in both domains, the interesting question is the relative importance of these two things that both matter. And I think there's very good reason to argue that the relative importance of technology is lower on land, and the relative importance of technology is higher at sea and in the air above the sea.
Yeah, definitely highlights the importance of innovation in the maritime domain, especially.
Indeed.
Moving on to the next question, what strategic and operational advantages are offered by a blockade versus other acts of war, and how could blockade complement both Chinese and U.S. strategies in a Pacific conflict?
Yeah, blockade has, of course, played a big role in the debate over the military balance in the Western Pacific. Usually people assume that it's something the United States is going to do to China, especially distant blockade at maritime straits that the Chinese would use, especially to import oil. And it seemed to my co-author and I when we were writing the paper that, yes, that's an important capability, but that it's too narrow a way of thinking about blockade. And in particular, A2AD is a natural blockade weapon. If, again, you assume a two-sided long-term competition in which both sides are doing this sort of thing, then the capacity of the Chinese to invade Taiwan or Japan or other U.S. allies in the region will be very, very limited, because our ability to exclude the logistical shipping the Chinese would need to sustain an amphibious invasion ashore would be very powerful, and we think it's very unlikely that China would be able to master what is at best an extremely demanding logistical challenge, amphibious invasion, in this kind of environment. By contrast, even if you have mutual A2AD exclusion over an area of water, that sets up a very impressive blockade potential. Perhaps Chinese surface shipping couldn't get access to Taiwan, but if Taiwanese surface shipping can't get access to Taiwan, then Taiwan is looking at a potential economic catastrophe. Not only does the country's commercial economy depend on trade, keeping the population fed depends on trade. And in fact, many of the United States' major allies in the region are island nations that are dependent for their very survival on seaborne commerce. If anti-access and area denial is used to deny access to commercial shipping bound for these ports, that is potentially a very impressive coercive lever that China could use to contest control of the various territorial stakes that constitute the normal casus belli in conversations about a potential U.S.-China war in the region. So we tend to focus more attention than most on the prospect, not just of the United States blockading China, but on the prospect of China blockading U.S. allies, because that looks to us like a more viable threat than amphibious invasion, and also a more viable threat in a variety of ways than missile-based strategic bombing. The same technologies that create A2AD, of course, can also destroy power plants. They can destroy bridges and communication systems, and can be used to do what Americans have traditionally used airplanes to do, essentially a form, of course, of strategic bombing. But whereas coercive strategic bombing hits targets that are ashore and often in close proximity to populated areas, and therefore is very likely to involve large scales of collateral damage, not just to the civilian economy, but also to civilian lives, blockade need not, because blockade takes place at sea against container ships that in the modern world have remarkably small crews. It would in principle be possible for a Chinese coercive campaign aimed at the interdiction of maritime shipping to impose a truly impressive level of economic pain on U.S. allies while killing very few civilians and while physically destroying very little civilian property, and therefore posing substantially lower escalatory perils in a potential competition with a nuclear-armed superpower like the United States. We therefore think that a two-sided consideration of blockade in an A2AD environment is an increasingly necessary part of the strategic debate.
Seems politically less costly as well, the escalatory dynamics, the risk of retaliation, and also domestically, if you're pursuing a strategy where your own soldiers aren't at the front lines dying, it also does make it easier to pursue that strategy.
Absolutely.
The U.S. Department of Defense is pursuing a third offset to restore conventional deterrence against peer competitors, with a particular emphasis on battle networks and human-machine teaming. In this vein, what sorts of capabilities and operational concepts do you see offsetting a mature Chinese A2AD capability and establishing a credible deterrent in the mid to long term?
Yeah, I mean, third offset is very much the flavor of the moment in the U.S. defense debate. I find it a difficult thing to evaluate, in part because it's so hard to pin down exactly what it is. Now that we've got offset language you know, floating around. The first offset was pretty easy to identify what it was. Nuclear weapons, right? I can hold one, I can point at one, I can talk about what it does, you can analyze their effects, and you know, there's a huge literature that did just that. The second offset, precision guidance, similarly is a relatively discrete set of things that you can talk about their effects in a relatively integrated, coherent way and build out some analysis of what it would do. The third offset is, you know, a pretty amorphous collection of things we think we're going to be good at. The connection between, for example, big data and robotics is kind of hard to pin down. So it's given that it has this kind of scattered amorphous quality to it, it's hard to produce a coherent assessment of it as a thing.
That's fair.
What one can do, though, it seems to me, is talk about the underlying physics of the problem when you're looking at this kind of long-term, mutually adaptive, two-sided A2AD competition, and ask what would you have to ask of artificial intelligence, or of big data, or of robotics, or of miniaturization, or all the various, you know, bins that make up the third offset. And especially in an environment where you reasonably can expect that the Chinese will be doing the same thing. And at the end of the day, I don't think any of these things overturn what we see as the central asymmetry at the heart of A2AD versus its assailants, which is the complexity of the Earth's surface as a military environment as opposed to the water and the air. So in an environment in which both sides are going to be getting better at big data, both sides are going to be deploying AI, both sides are going to be looking at robotics, ultimately, seekers and searchers in the air penetrating the Chinese mainland, looking down into this complex environment to try and find things, you know, air defense sites, mobile missile launchers, logistics bases, are looking at a background that poses a much more complicated targeting problem than they have looking up at you. You're silhouetted against an open sky. You're burning fuel at a prodigious rate in order to stay airborne, which means you're producing a tremendous amount of heat. You're moving very rapidly, which simplifies Doppler processing. You look at all these things, and there's a profound and systematic asymmetry between the survivability of things that can operate on the land in the midst of this complicated environment and things that cannot. And nothing that I see in the third offset will affect that underlying asymmetry in any profound way. It may very well improve both sides' ability to find each other, but it's the difference between the two that determines the outcome of the campaign, and the only source of fundamental asymmetry in this, again in a long-term, two-sided, mutually adaptive competition, is the asymmetry in the military environment that one is operating in. And I don't see the third offset overturning that.
What would be the strategic effects of China launching a first strike on U.S. Pacific allies and forward deployed forces in the region in a 2040 time frame, and what could such a strike entail?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the long-range precision-guided missile technologies we're talking about may or may not have an easy time finding mobile targets, but fixed targets are going to be increasingly vulnerable, and especially things like runways. So if the United States deploys in peacetime large air forces or naval assets in fixed forward bases, a preemptive strike will be able to destroy whatever we choose to deploy there. And it's going to be very difficult to provide terminal defenses that will protect those kinds of targets given their static nature and the increasing capacity of long-range missiles to destroy especially fixed targets. That does not, however, mean that China will have the ability to destroy the U.S. military in the Pacific. If, for example, the United States responds to a crisis by dispersing aircraft, some of which beyond the range of Chinese A2AD, or if the United States in peacetime simply deploys the majority of its military beyond the 400 to 600 kilometer plausible reach of Chinese A2AD, China will have very limited ability to preemptively destroy any assets that we don't deliver to them with gift wrapping on it by pre-deploying them on fixed bases within reach of Chinese missiles. Mobile targets, once radar satellites are destroyed and once airborne radars are restricted to a 400 to 600 kilometer reach from the Chinese mainland, will become very, very difficult to find. And that means that dispersal air bases, for example, or aircraft carriers or sea basing operating beyond the reach of Chinese A2AD will be able to provide basing assets that China will then have a very difficult time destroying. Especially if you posit an environment in the future in which, unlike modern, for example, airborne radars, a very important technology for A2AD, which were designed in an era in which the processing technology and the human crew needed to do that processing had to be carried in the airframe itself and held aloft. In the future, improvements in microelectronic technology and high bandwidth secure communications will allow more and more of that to be offloaded to mobile ground stations, which in turn enables the airplane to be made substantially smaller and therefore able to operate from smaller and smaller, less and less elaborate basing structure. In fact, it's plausible to imagine that airborne radars with range comparable to that of today's JSTARS in the future can be put on airplanes that can operate off of unimproved highway. And in an environment in which you can, if necessary, operate from unimproved highway, or you can simply operate from small regional airports, and in which runway repair continues to mature in the way that it has in the last two generations, it becomes harder and harder to imagine that a cost-effective competition between basing attack and basing repair and basing dispersal can be won by the attacker. Assets forward deployed in peacetime and struck preemptively will be very vulnerable. Their replacements, once long-range surveillance is taken down, will be vastly more survivable.
What strategic and operational benefits and limitations do Chinese naval forces incur by operating under an A2AD envelope in the Western Pacific?
Yeah, I mean, we tend to believe that naval assets that venture within range of an American A2AD zone are going to be extremely vulnerable in the same way that American naval assets would be if they sailed into the teeth of the Chinese A2AD system. So if the competition unfolds in the way that we expect, we're going to be looking at an environment in which surface maritime operations within reach of the enemy's A2AD are simply going to be too vulnerable. What that means, however, is that naval assets can be viable if either A, they're operating more than 400 to 600 kilometers away from enemy-held land areas, or B, if they're operating in close inland waters where they're within reach of protection by anti-missile systems that are deployed in a mobile basing mode on land amidst the complexity that I talked about earlier. That suggests in turn, though, that if the way China is going to think about a future war with the United States is by building a seagoing blue water navy that's going to sally forth and extend the reach of Chinese A2AD beyond 400 to 600 kilometers, which cannot threaten U.S. allies like, for example, Japan or South Korea, and instead use naval assets to extend that bubble further out, they're going to have a great deal of difficulty enabling those surface naval platforms to survive because they're going to have to move within reach of friendly, U.S.-friendly A2AD capabilities deployed either on South Korean territory or in Filipino territory or in Taiwanese territory.
How do you envision deception operations factoring into the strategy for both those forces seeking to deny access and secure it in the region?
Well, I mean, in a sense, the whole analysis I just presented is premised on an argument about deception. It's premised on the argument that the complexity of the Earth's surface makes things hard to find, which, in a sense, is a form of deception. Cleverer forms of deception, I mean, causing the corpses of convicts to wash ashore with phony orders in their pockets, and so on, just to take analogies from an earlier era, have increasing difficulty in an environment in which RISTA, reconnaissance, surveillance, and target acquisition technologies, is getting as good as it's going to be. Now, certainly there are all sorts of forms of electronic deception that are part and parcel of these technologies. But at the end of the day, we tend to think that the power of searchers, if the environment is conducive, is going to make it harder and harder to hide unless the environment is conducive. A two-sided searcher-hider competition where the hider is embedded in the complexity of your surface is a situation in which the hider can use deception and win. Using deception to win if you're a stealth bomber trying to penetrate into a heavily defended airspace silhouetted against a blank sky, burning huge amounts of fuel, moving at very high speed into the teeth of very powerful mobile land-based radars, isn't a deception strategy we think has much potential.
Thank you so much. This was a really fantastic conversation, Professor Biddle, and I'm really excited to be able to get this out to our listeners.
My pleasure.
That concludes episode 130 of Sea Control from the Center for International Maritime Security. A special thanks to all of our tireless producers, Ryan Yulia and Roman Vidaus. And if you enjoyed this episode but haven't already yet subscribed to Sea Control, please do. Subscribing gives you automatic access to all of our episodes as they become available. And if you really like us, go on over to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next time on Sea Control.